Today is October 9th, 2014. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Legacy Archive, I am interviewing Michael Page over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Michael, can you begin with when and where you were born?
I was born in New York City, September 23rd, 1938, right, and Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, and that's the beginning.
Tell me a little bit about your family and where you grew up.
Okay, I was born. I'm the eldest of five children. I have four siblings, sister a couple years younger, another sister 5 or 6 years younger, and another sister, and then a younger brother. We moved to Lower Westchester County, Pelham, New York, and then we moved to Briarcliff, which is about 20 miles north, and then the family went to Pelham High School and graduated from Pelham High School. And then my life pursued my equestrian career.
Mm-hmm. Before you became involved with equestrian sports, were there any other athletic pursuits that you undertook before then?
No. When I was 10 years old, I think I was watching black and white television, and I dreamed of becoming a Pony Express rider. Mm. I liked the idea of going fast as you could on a horse, shooting the bad guys, going under the neck at a fast gallop, and ultimately the sport that I became involved in sort of basically pretty much that's what it was all about in the beginning, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the only sport that I've ever really been interested in from the time I was 10 was riding horses. Mm-hmm. And being involved with horses.
How did you first become involved in equestrian sports?
Right. Well, we lived in Pelham, New York, which is Lower Westchester, and there was what they call hack stable, you know, where you lease out horses.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to be able to walk down there when I was 12 or 13 and be able to sit on the horses when they were in the stalls. So it's been an innate passion, you know, to be involved with horses and riding since I was very young. And I have never done any other sports other than casually, you know, play catch or throw football or swing a golf club, but only in the most casual manner. I've pursued my passion my whole life.
Mm-hmm. And how did your family members support your endeavors to enter equestrian sports?
Well, when I was, you know, in high school, I used to take lessons once a week, and you know, I was the only boy in high school that had riding clothes on, so I was sort of a little bit of an outcast, but it never bothered me. I used to ride my bicycle from home to the barn, which was 12 miles back and forth, and, you know, till I went, you know, all through, you know, school. And then when I graduated from high school, my father discussed with me my ambitions and advised me that whatever I pursued with the same passion, I might not be able to get certain jobs because of lacking a college education, but if I pursued it with the same passion, I would always do well. So he suggested that instead of going to college, I go to Europe to continue the riding that was possible over there that we were in no position to be able to afford in this country. So that's how I sort of evolved.
Hmm. And why Europe why was Europe more affordable to pursue the sport than the U.S.?
Well, in Europe, there is a history of classical education in a lot of sports, you know, that this country didn't have. And, you know, when I was 15, I was sitting with my father at home, and I was reading a horse magazine, and he said, "Michael, we don't have much money, right, and you don't ride very well, so it would probably be a useful thing for you to do to go to England, because you can speak English and study the beginnings of a classical education in equestrian riding." So I had a saddle and a suitcase, and I went on the boat called the Liberté when I was 15, and rode for the summer in England with Captain Eddie Goldman at the Cheshire Equestrian Center. And he was a leading trainer in Europe. And I came back, and because of that, I won the major equitation finals at Madison Square Garden when I was 17. And then 2 weeks after that, my father said I could have what it would cost to go to college, which was $3,600 a year they would send me. And I returned to England and then went to Switzerland. He said the only thing I had to do was learn the language of any country that I rode. And so I went to Switzerland and went to l'école de commerce in Neuchâtel and lived in a pension and rode in Switzerland. And while I was in Switzerland, there was a groom at the Swiss stable who suggested that it was possible to go to Saumur, the French cavalry school, for the first time. And they had foreigners that could go to the school. And so I did a 2-week summer course. And then because I had won the equitation finals in New York, when I was going to Germany to ride, I stopped at the Fédération Française des Sports Équestres in Paris. And General Boucault, who was the executive director, said, "Who are you?" Right? And I said, "Well, my name is Michael Page, and I heard that you can go to the French cavalry school." And he said, "Well, it's very fortunate for you, because this is the first year that we're ever having civilian riders ride at the French cavalry school." And he said, "If you can get a reference letter from your federation, it might be possible for you to be one of, start the first year." So because I had won the junior championship at Madison Square Garden, they knew who I was. And so I was accepted to Saumur, the French cavalry school, where I rode 9 horses a day, was a member of the officers' mess, the NCO mess, and the person who became and rode French army horses, and it cost $65 a month. And my father was sending me $300 a month, and I was able to save enough money to have my parents come over and visit me at Saumur. And I rode in the French national championships on French army horses and was good enough to be noticed by the United States team. And John Galvin in California had just bought 6 Olympic-type horses for his daughter, 3-day horses. And she decided she didn't want to ride eventing and took up dressage. And so I got a telegram when I was in Europe after, 3 years, and saying that since I had been successful and sort of been kept on the radar of the team, that if I was available, John Galvin had purchased Olympic horses, that he was sponsoring the team and would pick up all the costs, and would I be interested in coming back to the States and trying out for the 59 Pan American Games, which I won the individual gold medal, and the 60 Olympics, and then the 64, 63 Pan American Games and the 64 Olympic Games, and then finally the 67 Pan American Games and the 68 Olympic Games. So that all sort of was how it came to be.
Mm-hmm. So you've had quite a bit of Olympic experience.
Well, I've been very fortunate. I've never owned a horse in my life. And, you know, the circumstances sort of came together where I was at the right place at the right time, having, you know, the right assistance. And I, because of my time at the 2 years at the French Cavalry School, I could ride pretty well. And the horses that Galvin had bought for his daughter were, you know, world-class horses. So that was the beginning of my Olympic experience.
Mm-hmm. So we'll talk about some of the other games that you were involved in, but going
right
straight to 68,
right, yep.
What were some of your memories of the trials for 68? How did the trials to make the 68 team work?
Yeah, the trials, there was a training session at the USET headquarters at Gladstone, New Jersey. And you know, the horses were team horses that I was riding. I never owned a horse, and so I had a horse, Foster, who was loaned to the team, and I got the opportunity to ride. And he was with the trials were at Gladstone, and then we went to Europe to Badminton, which is the biggest event in the world, you know, as a training time before the 68 Olympics. So it was, you know, it was all team sponsored. That makes sense to you?
Yes.
Okay.
So, how did your friends and family react to finding out that you were going to be on the Olympic team the first time in 1960 when you first made the team?
You know, it was just sort of, you know, I'd been on my own for, you know, in Europe for the 3 or 4 years, and I got a telegram over there, and you know, I called my father and said this was an opportunity, and he said, well, you know, you're a lucky person, right? You should come back and, you know, we'll, you know, get you. I had a Jeepster. I drove out to California, and, you know, it was a little Jeep. And, you know, it was one of the horses that Galvin had bought for his daughter, happened to be a horse that had done the Stockholm Olympics in 56, and was one of the best horses in the world. And I'm small, and the horse was small, so that was the horse I was given. And because of my riding time in Europe for the 4 years, you know, I was able to sort of ride him and respect him. And he put up with me. And so we went to the Pan American Games in Chicago in 59 and won the individual gold medal, and team won the silver medal. And then he was my ride in Rome. And I had two falls, one of them opening my eyes under the water. But, you know, he was lying next to me, and I was thinking of myself being a Pony Express rider. So as he was getting up out of the water, I jumped on him, and we finished 17th at Rome. So that was sort of the culmination of my dreams. I actually had a horse that probably was the fastest in the world.
Wow.
You know, I was, you know, it was like, cool. You know, you get, you know, you sort of have had the opportunity to prepare for something special, and something special happens.
Mm-hmm.
So that was Rome. And then the same horse, he was one of the, I think, four horses in the world that ever did three Olympic Games, the horse. He did Stockholm, Rome, and he did Tokyo with me. And he finished fourth individually, like a point, and we won the team silver medal. And then he was retired after that. He was 16. And then I retired from riding for a couple of years and judged, and did some, you know, involvement with horses, but worked in the city. And then I got a call from the team headquarters at Gladstone, which is in New Jersey, saying that, you know, they had some extra horses, and would I be interested in coming back and trying out for the 68 Olympic Games. And so I spoke to my father again, and he said that it was certainly, you know, a possibility. And Gladstone, I was working in the city, and Gladstone was by train 3 hours from Gladstone. My grandfather owned a building at 19 West 4th Street on Washington Square, you know, which NYU bought after that. And so I used to commute from Gladstone 3 hours to work, and then go back to Gladstone, you know, and train. So it was a very fortuitous situation, because when I came back to the team, you know, where the horses were, the girl that was taking care of the horse that I was given, I started dating. And it's 47 years since, and we're still together and have done the horses all our lives together. And she was, without her, I wouldn't have commuted 6 hours a day to New York and then back, and she'd have the horse ready at 4:30 in the morning, and I'd come down, you know, off we go ride, and then she'd take me to the train station at Gladstone, and I'd go into the city, and then I'd get back about 7:30, and then we go have dinner. And then because of her, you know, I was willing to put up with the commute and the stuff that went on. And, you know, we've been together ever since. So it's the horses have given me, you know, almost everything in my life, you know, other than you have to work hard to, you know, to maintain it and keep it and be successful at it. How's that? Is that enough?
Yeah, that's wonderful so far.
Right, good. I'm glad to hear that.
So were your training methods in preparation for the games different from the methods and techniques that you normally used for?
No. They're basically the same. Mm-hmm. You know, basically, you know, 60, 64, 68. The horses were different. The people were different. But the training methods, you know, the best 3-day eventing, you know, what they call the military, was in Europe. So we used to go to Europe. Then the biggest event in the world was a place called Badminton in England. And that's where we did our final, you know, preparation. You had to participate, you know, it was like, you know, the world championships or something like that, you know, really tough. And, you know, if you were successful there, you knew you were a world-class, you know, position. And then, you know, then the team selection came after that. So you had to get to a certain standard, you know, of excellence. And then, you know, those riders who were riding at that level then were, you know, assembled at the team training headquarters at Gladstone, New Jersey. And, you know, then there were, you know, the final selection trials, you know, depending on the fitness of the horse, fitness of the rider, you know, their competitive success, their experience, you know, all those things came together. And then we went off to Evandro in Mexico. And, you know, basically, you know, I wouldn't have gone if I hadn't, you know, had the horse I had, or the wife that I've had for, you know, all these years.
Mm-hmm. Were you at all concerned about the altitude of Mexico City?
No. I, it was the same for everybody, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our horses were fit. And, you know, it was a different competition, because, you know, halfway through the competition, they had a monsoon. And I fortunately went, you know, early in the competition, so I didn't have the problems of the rains, right? So it was, again, fortuitous, you know, because, you know, I wound up, you know, third this time, you know, and we won the silver medal, the team silver medal. So it was, you know, it was good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like to ride, you know, that's what I like to do.
Yeah.
And when you, get on a horse, you know, and what you have to do is you have to do enough so that it becomes natural that you let the horse be. If he's a great horse, he's not compromised by a shitty rider, right? And, you know, if you get lucky enough to, you know, form the combination with, you know, horses are different, people are different, personalities are different, you know, styles are different, but, you know, you ultimately, you know, create a combination. I think it's like in everything, even in team sports, you know, the sum of the parts, you know, better is better than the individual, right? So, you know, and that's the same thing with the horses. You have to sort of, you know, become a partnership with it. And, you know, it also has to be a great horse. You know, the type of event that we do was, when I first started, it was 22 miles in the speed and endurance, because it was originally called the military. And then it started in 1936 in, I think it was Stockholm, again, early. But they were all officers, chargers, that competed against each other, and they had to perform like they would have done when they were fighting wars, where they had to go, you know, 50 miles with a troop of 5,000 horses, and they had to get there fitter and stronger than the other 5,000 horses so they could kill everybody. I mean, that's basically what the military was, you know. But obviously, when the tanks and the other stuff, the jeeps and everything, started taking over, their horses became expendable. But in the First World War, there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of, you know, horses, you know, that were part of the cavalry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what the event became. And now it's more of a technical event. It's changed over the years. When I first started riding in Rome, the speed and endurance was 22 miles. And now it's down to like 4 or 5 miles at the Olympic level. So it's changed a lot. It's become much more technical. Jumps are bigger, more technical, you know, harder. But the endurance is much, much less.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, I wouldn't have been a Pony Express rider now, right?
I mean,
I had to go in my day.
Yeah. So, changing tracks a little bit.
Yep.
As you were preparing to go down to Mexico for the games,
right,
do you remember,
yep,
hearing anything about possible protests or boycotts by members of the U.S. Olympic team?
Of the what Olympic? Who?
By members of the U.S. Olympic team, the United States.
Never even came on our radar.
Mm-hmm.
That I know of, anyhow. Mm-hmm. Not that I remember. Right. There was nothing, you know. And our event was not in Mexico City. It was in a place called Avondero, which was about, I think, 100 kilometers from Mexico City. You know, down at a lower altitude than Mexico City.
I see.
So it that the and we were separate, and I never even went up to walk in the opening ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we were training. So, you know, it was different.
So, did you participate in the Little Olympics, which was kind of like a trial Olympics that was held the year before, I believe?
No,
okay,
definitely not. I did the Pan American Games, and they were in Winnipeg, Canada.
Okay.
1967, right? Yep.
Do you remember hearing anything about student protests and violence in Mexico City about 10 days before the start of the games?
If you're asking me now, how long ago were the 68 games?
44 years ago.
Yeah, 44 years ago. I have to tell you that it was nothing that affected me enough to remember anything about it. You know, we were concerned with the horses, with No. If you're asking me now, 44 years later, do I remember anything, or was it on the radar of what we were worried about or doing? I think there might have been something talking about some of the unrest in Mexico City,
mm-hmm.
but where we were going was separate from Mexico City, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't even on the, you know, and, you know, Prince Philip was the head of the head technical delegate, and we were off in I wouldn't say isolated area, but we were off in a separate area, so it was nothing that happened in Mexico City was on our radar, or at least my radar.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been on the team's radar, but at the competition level, what we worried about was preparing for the competition.
Mm-hmm. What were your impressions of Mexico and its preparations for the games when you arrived?
You know, we spent very little time in Mexico City. I think we spent a couple of days. And then the horses, you know, everybody shipped to Evandro. So our experience was much, much different from those that were competing in Mexico City and spent a couple of weeks there. You know, we spent 2 days there, and then, you know, went in the bus or however, you know, caught up with our horses who were shipped directly, you know, from Mexico City down to Evandro.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, you know, it was a very superficial connection to the actual, you know, tension or whatever was going on with whatever the protests or this or that. And, you know, for me, it was great games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's better to win a couple of medals than not.
Can you describe your accommodations in Evandro?
Yeah, we had little, it was a golf course, you know, with bungalows. And all the teams were assigned bungalows on the golf course, and the golf course was where the cross country was held, and they had a show jumping arena and a dressage arena, and felt pleasant. You know, the only thing that really concerned is the participation in the actual competition. But it was a bungalow. It was each team had their own bungalow. I remember going to the French team bungalow because the coach of the French team was a friend of mine from Sumer, who was had been my coach when I was riding at Sumer for the 2 years. We were insulated from whatever else was going on.
Mm-hmm. What about the security measures where you were? What were your impressions of security measures there?
My impressions were we were in an isolated community of just horse people preparing for, you know, our competition, and we were in Mexico. And we were, I think, a couple of thousand feet lower than Mexico City. So everybody felt good about that because of the type of competition we had. And the facilities were fine. We were only going to be there for a couple weeks. And, we were there to compete. And, the other nations were there to compete. And it was, you know, this is my third game. So, you know, and third Pan American game. So it was, the peripheral stuff were completely adequate for being able to do the job, other than the monsoon that came halfway through the speed and endurance part changed the dynamics of the competition and benefited me.
Mm-hmm. So, what about the food and drink? Did you or anyone you know have any illness from the food or water?
Nope. Everybody's fine. Nope. It was good. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wouldn't say the food was good, but it was, you know, it was like, you know, cafeteria food, and it all was fine. Mm-hmm. And that's what I remember after 44 years, right? I can't tell you what I ate, but it seemed to be, you know, like most games, you know, they went out of their way to, you know, make it a, you know, international type, you know, eating place, right, for all the teams. And it was seemed fine.
Did you have any memorable interactions with people from other national teams?
Well, I mean, the French team, since I had ridden with the boy who won the individual gold medal for the 2 years when I was in France, and the coach of the French team were friends of mine. So I would say with them. And then there was the one incident that sort of was, and this I can't say for a fact that actually transpired, but on the last day, I told you, I was fourth in Tokyo individually. And so I was going up to the last show jumping. I was fourth individually. And I said, that's the worst place to be again. And then the last rider was a Russian rider. And the Russian rider was going for the individual gold medal. And if he jumped a clean round, I would stay fourth. And what he did was he went off course and was eliminated. So I moved up to third and got to stand on the podium. And the word going around was that Prince Philip, who was the head of the ground jury, was that they had caught, this is what was the rumor, mm-hmm. was that the Russians had been caught using walkie-talkies on the cross-country course, and instead of making an international incident of it, they had come to the conclusion that, you know, if they eliminated the team, nothing would have been said. So that was just whether it was a rumor or a fact, I have no idea. But all I know was that, you know, all he had to do was jump, I think, two more jumps in a straight line, and he turned and went the wrong way. And so I would say that was a pivotal moment in my Olympic career. And when I got back home, I decided that should be the last event that I ever rode in. So, which is pretty much what happened.
Did you make that decision?
I always had to work, and we had a factory that made hat linings and jewelry. Damn it! And I was in sales, so that's why I got the freedom to sort of come and go and ride. And I knew that the other boys on the team were going to continue to keep on riding as, you know, semi-professional or professional, and I had to go back to work. And I just figured that, you know, when you sort of got as far as you could have possibly hoped to get, that there comes a time when it wasn't a question that I couldn't ride anymore, but to try to do what I had done for the previous, 10 years or so was silly when I could just ride and enjoy what I wanted to do without having the pressure of knowing that I could never do it as well. Hmm. Right? That's pretty much, you know, when I was going on the plane back, it was Eastern Airlines, and I was sitting in the back and I had my two medals around, and the stewardess came up and said, oh, do you view the Olympics? And I said, yes. And she said, oh, that's wonderful. Here, come up to first class. And I remember as I was walking up to first class, I said, you know, it doesn't get any better than this, right? This is cool, but it isn't going to happen again. So you might as well enjoy it and just have the good memories of what you did and not try to emulate them in the future when practically it was never going to happen again.
Hmm.
Okay?
Yep. That makes sense. Yeah, very reasonable. Very, very reasonable.
Right?
I think more people today need to take that approach.
Well, I'm you have to take it for who you are. You know, if you have, $40 million, then you don't have to work for a living, right? But my father had sacrificed to let me go do what I had done, and, you know, it was a family business, and, you know, I appreciated what he had done, what knowledge and great, you know, ability to think for me and give me the right ability to make smart choices and get where I got without having any money or, you know, just being advised in a good way to do smart things. You know, it was a very rewarding experience when I looked at it in that perspective. And, you know, you can't try to, you know, do things without having the opportunity to try to do them well, mm-hmm. right? So it was, and I still look back and think about 68, and you know, the best picture I have of my whole equestrian career is, you know, on the podium in Mexico, and my wife, Georgette, is holding the horse behind me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if it hadn't been for her, I probably would have given up the six-hour commute back and forth to Gladstone. And there she was, because of her, you know, standing, holding the horse. It's something that sort of ties a valuable part of your life together, you mm-hmm. know, and you have to appreciate it. Mm-hmm. So it's good.
So you mentioned the incident with the Soviet rider earlier.
Right.
How did the Soviet methods of training and doing eventing compare to the U.S. method?
Right. You know, I think that, you know, everybody, you know, back in those days, the speed and endurance came from the cavalry. You know, the Russians had cavalry, the Germans had cavalry, the French had cavalry, the United States had cavalry, right? You know, one of the things that's interesting to me when you talk about, you know, the event was initially called the military, right? And in 63, I was drafted in the Army, and I happened to be able to, and I loved the military from my time at Sumer, and one of the generals who was involved in the horses and knew that I was a rider, and I got orders and went out to Fort Ord in California, and I rode in the 63 and 63 Pan American Games and 64 while I was in the Army. So I was the last actual Army Olympic rider in the world. And I have pictures of me in uniform in Fort Ord holding my, because I used to go out to the service club and work there. But I had to, you know, dress in uniform. And when I won the national championships out of Pebble Beach, you know, I wore my dress uniform, you know, Army uniform, and, you know, and won the national 3-day championships. I didn't ride in military because I wasn't an officer, but, you know, so it was, I had cool things happen to me. It was, like, cool.
Definitely. So, 1968 was the first right. Summer Games at which a drug testing program was implemented.
Right.
Did you have any experience with this drug testing program?
You know, I can't. I'm sure, you know, I don't know whether it was, did they take blood or what did they do?
It was, I think, random urine samples or urine samples from.
Oh, yeah, I think I remember doing something, right? I mean, I never had to worry about that. The riders that I knew were all the time, you know, and all the French, and, you know, there was never any, you know, our sport, the only one, you know, would have possibly have drug testing for it in those days were the horses, you know, not the riders, mm-hmm. right? So there was never any, you know, it's become much more stringent with the horses, you know, and riders. But mm-hmm. in those days, I don't even know whether the horses were tested or not. They must have been tested, mm-hmm. right?
So that was going to be my next question, was about the drug testing of the horses. Just, you know, any experiences with that or anything that you remember?
Nothing that ever transpired that was negative. Mm-hmm. We might have fallen on our heads a couple of times, but it had nothing to do with drugs or anything. No, it was, we were sort of insulated from, we're not athlete. We're pseudo athletes. It's the horse is the one that's the real athlete. And, you know, obviously you have to be dead fit and ride hours and hours a day, but it's not a question of strength or anything. It's a question of being, you know, sitting on the horse and, you know, riding enough so that you're comfortable riding and staying on, you know. It's what it boils down to. So the drug stuff was nothing that we ever sort of thought about much or worried about much. And if you got tested, urine tested, right, fine. Uh-huh. No big deal.
What about other national teams? Were there any concerns that other teams, like the Soviets or the French, were using equine doping?
That was never a part of what anyone thought about. Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing about the walkie-talkies on the cross-country, that was something that, you know, that might not even have been true. It might have just been the rumor, because how could anyone be that stupid, right? I mean, you could win an individual gold medal and then you go off course, right? And that would be the only sort of question that in all the years that I've been, that have been, something that I've been aware of. I mean, in the management situation, there might have been things that have happened. You know, we have horses that get hurt, in 68, I almost flipped over and the horse hit the jump so hard that his two front shoes came off. So when he came back in off the cross country, his feet were, just like worn down. I wouldn't say they were bloody because it was still wet on the cross country. But so there was a real problem about getting shoes on for the show jumping on the next day. But that my wife took care of that. And, the farrier that we had there was one of the world's great farriers, blacksmiths. So he got the shoes on and, the horse jogged sound and jumped clean and I won a bronze medal. Mm. So it was nice.
Mm-hmm. So 1968, those games are remembered for the Smith and Carlos silent protest salute on the medal stand.
Right.
Do you remember when that happened? And
Nope. The only thing I remember about it is I see it on TV.
Mm-hmm. And when you saw it on TV back then, what was your reaction?
I don't know. I don't remember what my reaction was.
No worries.
This 44 years ago, right?
Yes.
And 44 years, I'm still doing exactly what I did back then, not at Olympic level, but with the same passion that I had back then for it. So, things are going on all over the world now that are, 10 times as bad or 10 times as good, right? And, still keep, it's part of who we are, our societies, et cetera, et cetera, mm-hmm. right? So,
how do you feel about the games being known for that moment?
It doesn't concern me. Mm-hmm. I the games, as far as I'm concerned, are only for the moments that I had there. Mm-hmm. So it really, if you're asking me as a participant in the 68 games, as a competitor, as someone who won 2 medals. Right. Those are my memories of the games. Everybody in the world who didn't participate might think that that was the the focus of the games. Mm-hmm. But for those of us who participated, it was our moments, and they were important in the dimension of how the games affected us personally,
mm-hmm.
not how they affected the rest of the world and those two individuals who were making a statement for what they believed in.
Mm-hmm. What did it feel to stand on the, what did you feel when you were standing on the medal podium?
I said, holy shit, this is great. I am so glad I'm not fourth again. That's exactly what I said. And I can't say that I turned and winked at my wife. I mean, she wasn't my wife. She was my girlfriend, right?
Uh-huh.
But it was cool to see her standing there. And I still have the picture of her in her pigtails, right, standing holding the horse. And that's, you know, it's something that today I can look at and say that was a really cool time in my life.
Mm-hmm. What did you do immediately after your event and the medal ceremony?
I immediately went to the airport because my father had asked me to get back to the office as quickly as I could. Got on an airplane, right, and went back to New York and went to work.
Hmm. So no time off, no traveling, no vacation?
No. My time off, my traveling was done when I was riding and competing, and, you know, that would, you know, I had like 12 years, right? So, you know, it was, you know, and if it hadn't been for my father's guidance intelligence, you know, and giving me a way to achieve what I wanted to achieve, you know, it never would have happened. So, you know, it doesn't work only one way. When you appreciate what someone has done for you, you want to reciprocate in the only way you can.
Mm-hmm. Describe your homecoming reception.
I don't remember. I think everybody was happy. Right. I think, you know, when you get back to New York, it's when you have your suitcases with all the stuff in it. Right. And I had four siblings. I think they were all excited to get their Olympic stuff. That was, you know, we had a small family, you know, we have, you know, it's like, you know, the equestrian events in those days, you know, don't play on a national stage. They played on a, you know, very limited stage. And, you know, it was sort of, you still, you know, you know, your life was connected to the horses, you know, not to anything much else.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, your family was involved with you, but, you know, not involved. And, you know, when you have four younger brothers and sisters, I used to look forward to showing them all the, you know, the Olympic stuff that you get. And, you know, you get a lot of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you get those two big suitcases and a, you know, one of the smaller bags, and, you know, it's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amateurism is a big
right.
hot topic these days, because some people
right.
say that there's no true amateurism anymore. But I wanted to ask you what your experiences were in the time that you were competing in the games with the rules of eligibility for amateurism, and how you feel things have changed over time.
Oh, they really changed. I mean, you know, but you know, the one thing that was great, it was there was a, you know, a federation, a team federation that supported the riders. When there was, you know, in 59, 60, there was an individual who stepped forward and bought horses and, you know, I think gave us a stipend, you know, for, you know, just living expenses, I think. I don't remember. But anyhow, it, you know, it's a... You know, now the Olympic athletes, you know, make, you know, don't you get money for winning gold medals and silver medals and bronze medals now?
I believe so. That's what I've heard,
yeah.
But I'm not sure of the fact.
In our days, there was no money. Never received a penny for winning. Yeah, now there's no, I don't think there's any amateurism.
Hmm.
I mean, the tennis players, you know, Federer and whoever, you know, played tennis, the skiers or, you know, there's, you know, it's all professional. You know, I think, you know, the X Games, they might be amateurs, but the reason they get to be good amateurs is so they can, you know, get market, you know, stuff, right? I mean, it's, you know, I think it's all, you know, and in 1964 was the first year that women were allowed to compete equally with men. And Lana DuPont was the reserve rider, and she was the first woman rider to ride in the Olympic Games in our event, right? So, you know.
And how was that received? Since you were in that community, how did the community receive the change?
I think that it was, you know, it was an Olympic rule. You know, because it came from the military, you know, from 1936, you know, it was all men that rode in cavalry, right? And, you know, the sport was, you know, pretty brutal, you know, as far as, you know, the distances and everything. And then because women did compete, you know, in, not in Olympic sports, but in, you know, in world-class competitions like badminton and were very successful, then the IOC changed the rule that women were allowed to compete equally with men in 1964, and Lana was the first female rider. And now, you know, just in the current world championships, in our event, a German lady rider won the individual world championship. So it's evolved, and I would say, you know, maybe two of the two best riders in the world are men, you know, third and fourth are women, you know, so it's, you know, it depends. You know, I'd say they're more the top class, you know, or percentage-wise are probably men, but women, there are some women that beat all of men sometimes at the very top level. Maybe not all the time, but every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, yes.
In 68, gender testing was introduced that summer,
right,
for the games.
Right.
Do you remember anything about that?
Nothing. No, nothing. We were in Evandro. You know, if there was testing, then everybody got tested, right? Or whatever it was, right?
Uh-huh.
But as far as it being an issue that one discussed, one didn't discuss anything. We were just worried about preparing the horses and getting ready to ride,
mm-hmm,
and enjoying the whole idea. Olympics are a big deal. You know, 68 was a great games. You know, I mean, as far as Americans were concerned, you know, we did very well. The show jumping team, Billy Steinkraus, won the individual gold medal in show jumping. So, you know, we had a very good representation at the 68 games.
Mm-hmm. What has been the impact of being an Olympian on your life? Have there been any benefits?
Oh, I think the biggest benefit is just saying I was an Olympian, and it's cool. They're not everybody. I have those vanity plates on my car that said, say, MOP 68, and you know, you go someplace and say, oh, are you an Olympian? I said, right. I mean, it's a cool thing to have done. It's a cool thing to have been successful at it. You know, I still ride. That's what I do. That's my profession. So having done that, it's like the pinnacle of one's equestrian career, obviously, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody would like to be an Olympian. Everybody would like to win, you know, gold medal. But if you don't win a gold medal, at least it's nice to win some medals. So it's I think it did, you know, you're calling me on the phone, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I hadn't been in the Olympics in 1968, you would be calling somebody else, right? So, right? I mean, it's like, it's like, you know, a businessman wants to be successful. He wants to make money. A rider would like to go to the Olympics, right? It's, you know, it's, it impacts everything you do from then on, because it's an acknowledgement that, that what you worked hard at and what you love to do has been to, in certain standard, successful,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think that, you know, you look back on your career, and my career, and say, you know, how did I do with my career? And I could say, you know, having been an Olympian, having been in the 1968 Olympics, having met some of the friends I've met there, some of the people I've known throughout the world, you know, there's a common bond, and it's something that enhances the feeling of what you've done with your life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a very nice thing. I don't think it's the most important thing. I think being a good person and feeling that you've, you know, contributed in some small ways to other people is important. But, you know, if that's what you wanted to do and that's what you've done, it's cool.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the major comparisons that you would draw between Mexico City, Tokyo, and Rome in terms of your experiences?
Rome, I fell on. I almost drowned, right? Tokyo, I missed an individual medal by 1.5. And Mexico, I got lucky. And got an individual medal. I would say that's the way I look at the, you know, I mean, and in between, I love to ride, and I got a chance to go to 3 great Olympics and have experiences that very few other people have had.
Mm-hmm. What one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
I think you have to love your sport first and foremost. I think, you know, I don't think you get to be great without sort of enjoying the idea of becoming better. And I think unless you're passionate about becoming better, I don't think you get to become great. You know, I don't know of anybody who hasn't been either Olympian or a great athlete who haven't sacrificed almost everything in order to prove that they are the best, whether they get there or they don't get there. You know, I think it's, you know, I think the equestrian sports, you know, I think there's some great advantage to, you know, having money, because you can buy, you know, expensive horses, right, which helps, because you can't jump a 1.60 meter jump unless you have a horse that can jump a 1.60 meter,
mm-hmm.
right? So, but I think even those people that have to still work very hard to be able to ride those horses, and I think the hard work and dedication, you know, of any athlete that gets to the Olympics is a real reward for itself.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of Tom Lowe's team reassembly efforts, his efforts to try to reunite team members and keep the team united socially? How do you feel about that?
You know, I still work 7 days a week, right? And I think, you know, and I speak to him, I call him back every time he calls me, right? But, you know, I'm still, like, tomorrow I'm off to Chicago to do a clinic. You know, I have my 2015 schedule of, you know, clinics or judging or horse shows or something going on. So, you know, it's almost like what happened in 68 happened in 68, which is 44 years ago,
mm-hmm.
right? And, you know, every day that I wake up is sort of like a day of today. You know, it's like, you know, I look at the medals up on the wall, but hardly ever. You know, it's like, it's when someone like you calls, or when I speak to Tom, I say, you know, that's great. But, you know, I really don't spend much time thinking about the past unless I have someone like you or Tom that calls and talks about 68.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of like, you know, there were so many great things that, you know, I've had the opportunity to do and people to know and meet. It's, you know, it's one of the highlights, certainly, right? But when I look at me standing on the podium, I really look at my wife standing behind me there and think how cool that was.
Hmm.
You know, that's what excites me. That's what still excites me.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we close the interview today, Michael, is there anything else that you would like to tell me about?
No. All I wanted to do was answer as best I could in my limited fashion what you were interested in me responding to your questions about.
Well, you've done an excellent job, so thank you very much.
Young lady, it's a pleasure. And maybe you'll see my name at one of the horse shows around in, you know, San Diego, because I judge there.
Oh,
and you'll say, oh, I'll go over and see Michael.
Yeah.
Right? He won't recognize me, but I'll introduce myself, right?
Yeah, definitely. I'll keep that in mind.
Keep that in the back of your mind, right? Yes.
And Michael, before we go, I just wanted to ask, is it okay for us to share this recording to let researchers and students listen to it?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I don't say anything saying I said anything bad, right?
Okay.
It's what I believe, right?
Uh-huh.
And you have been an excellent interviewer.